Who doesn't love a campy horror flick with a message? Dear Camp 86 is coming to select theaters nationwide on May 31st. The film follows six knuckleheads from Detroit who travel up north for the annual tradition of deer hunting, but something horrific has been awakened, and the hunters become the hunted as an ancient spirit seeks vengeance for the death of a Native American girl. Let the fun, beer, gore, and revenge begin. Visit www.deercamp86.com to find showtimes near you.
Very well done, Scott. I'm here to tell you about another one of today's sponsors. That is The Order of the Malachi by John Grassi. In 12th century Germany, the medieval village of Arnost is plagued by an outbreak of vampirism. The Catholic Church sends their slayers, the Malachi, including the young Kale, Legrand, a French aristocrat, and Dennis, an aging German knight. As the Malachi hunt the undead, they trace their origins to the Lord of the Wood, an ancient vampire worshipped by a local witch cult. This leads to the torchlit duel between Legrand and the Lord of the Wood. The Malachi are then drafted into the crusader army of Frederick Barbarossa of Germany. During the long march to the Holy Land, the Malachi learn of the Reign of Terror by the Impaler of Carpathia, former prince and now powerful vampire. Legrand and Kale desert the army and ride north to the dark mountains of Carpathia. The Order of the Malachi is available on Amazon Kindle and Apple Books. For a free excerpt, check www.orderofthemalachi.com.
Nice. And finally, it's time to talk about our corporate overlords at Fangoria. In 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. It's been over 40 years, and they are better than ever, with each issue bringing you 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give anything away because we want the experience to be a surprise, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page. So head on over to Fangoria.com to learn more, to subscribe, and while you're there, make sure to enter the promo code KINGCAST to save 25% off your annual subscription.
Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Advise
me to
go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes death is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Eric Vespi.
And I'm Scott Wampler.
And we are your hosts. It's not often we get to welcome a guest that actually collaborated creatively with our show's namesake, but today we are making that reality happen. Our guest is a legendary Eisner, Eagle, Stan Lee, Harvey, and Inkpot award-winning comic book author who's worked for all the major publishers from Marvel and DC to Vertigo and Image on characters like Swamp Thing, Iron Man, Superman, and Batman, to name a few. He's behind the fan favorite Court of Owls storyline, I should mention. Before he helped change the face of DC Comics, he was a celebrated short story author whose work was handpicked by Stephen King to be included in 2007's The Best American Short Stories Anthology shortlist. And that's not where the King connection ends, my friends. He would later go on to create the very rad comic series American Vampire, the early issues of which he co-wrote with Stephen King. He has a new book coming out called White Boat, and issue number one is dropping this very day, May 22nd. He's here now to talk a little bit about that, as well as his thoughts on King's short story, One for the Road, which, I may remind you constant listeners, is his sequel to Salem's Lot. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Scott Snyder to the KingCast stage.
Yes.
Yep. Thank you guys so much for having me. It's such a thrill. I'm excited to talk all things Stephen King, and yeah, it's an honor. You've had a couple of my friends on here and so many great people that I'm just
delighted
grateful
to have you. And also, I'm going to be honest, like, I was excited to have you on. I'm familiar with your work, but apparently not so familiar that I realized you did Court of Owls, which fucking rules.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, like, yeah,
that was like Court of Owls was crazy because essentially it was my first year at DC Comics. I wound up sort of falling into the opportunity to write Batman on Detective Comics out of nowhere. And I was so green, and they picked me up from there and were like, okay, do you want to do Batman? And I was, it's basically, it was like being a single A baseball player and then getting, you know, the chance to pitch in the World Series Game 7 and being like, this is my dream. And yet I am not ready at all. I'm way too shitty at this point to do this. And so Court of Owls, it's funny, like people responded to it, you know, well, and I'm so grateful. But that whole year was like abject terror for me. If you want to talk about horror, I was like lived in a state of like complete imposter syndrome for the entire year, like nonstop.
Well, you fucking nailed it. I mean, like, I didn't read a lot of superhero comics, but I've read a lot of, like, I read Preacher and 100 Bullets and, you know, like those kind of comics. But yeah. Batman was the only superhero book that I collected the trades of. And oh my God, Court of Owls. So, who was the artist? Capullo was the artist?
Yeah, Greg Capullo. He's become like a really close friend. He's amazing. He's like, you know, because I'm like a neurotic kind of writer. And he's like this. He looks like he stepped right out of Sons of Anarchy as an artist. And he's like big, tough guy. And he's like, let's go. You know, and I'm sort of like, all right, let's do it. And so we make a really good team because I'm always like, what if we do this? But what if we did that? What if this? And he's like, we're doing it. And I'm like, okay, all right, here we go. So yeah, he's awesome. I love working with him.
Well, congratulations on that book. That was,
thank you.
And it's all the more impressive that you were thrown into this, like fucking, like DC was just, hey, you've never done anything before. Write Batman.
Yeah, well, it was literally happened. Like I got there because Grant Morrison, who is one of my idols and was so kind to me, like really Stephen King and Grant Morrison, probably, I mean, more than any other people. I'm trying to think of somebody else I've had other, you know, people that I've idolized that have been kind to me, but consistently kind. Those two have always been so encouraging when they had no reason to be. And he was there at that time. So I think I almost kind of slipped in under the radar because he was just doing such big explosive stuff that they were like, nobody cares about Detective Comics. Like, let's put him on that. And nobody cares about, you know, main Batman because Grant Morrison's doing Batman Inc. And at the time, so there was kind of this big, you know, marquee with Grant. And so I think maybe that's why, but I really don't know. I was there 1 year, had done American Vampire with Stephen King and Rafa. And I had done some detective, and then they were like, do you want to do Batman? And I was terrified. And I remember telling my wife, I think I got to turn it down. And she was like, no way, you got to do it. And then I got on it, and they were like, and it's going to be Batman number one, because it was at this moment when they relaunched all of their comics. Right. And I was like, there's not been a Batman number one in like 70 years. And they're like 75. Like, and I'm like, I really went back to my wife and was like, I have to quit. I have to quit. It was like, no, you got to do it. And so, I mean, yes, it was like it was very much like it was just like a year of like, try it like a night, one of those dreams where they're like, you need to fly the plane, it's crashing, but you're not a pilot, and it's like, you have to fly it backwards also, and you're like, but it was really like, you know, honestly, having worked with Steven and having that same kind of lesson really, you know, said to you over and over by people you admire, that like,
right,
just pretend nobody's reading it and write the thing that you would like to pick up and read that day. And that's the mantra of the class I teach too. It's just write the story that you would like to find on the shelves the most that day, whatever that is, and pretend like, you know, you don't know if anyone will ever pick it up, as opposed to you're working on this property that millions of people have opinions on and will hate you. Like, so yes, it was a very wild experience.
And of course you did American Vampire with Stephen King. I'm assuming that relationship started when he selected a few of your short stories for the Best American Short Stories shortlist.
Yeah, I mean, I had like an interesting relationship with him because, you know, I always he's always been my favorite writer. And you know, my what happened was I wound up going to graduate school in New York City at Columbia, and I became really good friends with another kid my age there named Owen. And it turned out that Owen, I didn't know when we started to become friends, but was, you know, Owen King. And so I had a relationship, or Stephen King sort of judged everything from those things blind. So
listen, I don't want to interrupt your story, but
yeah,
can you tell me about the moment where you found out?
Well, we were
flipping through your copy of It in front of him, and he was like, oh, Christ, here we go.
No, he made a comment, actually. What happened was you know, we were the same age. It was, there was one other kid our age, and we were all three of us still very good friends, or I'm you know, we're still really good friends, all of us. But, and I love Owen is like, I can't say enough good things about him as a human being and a writer. Go out and get the Curator. It's an incredible book. The guy has unbelievable chops. And so does, his wife, Kelly Braffett, is an amazing writer as well. And we met in graduate school too. That's where we all kind of came from. But we were becoming friends, and he made a comment while we were walking, on a road. My parents had a place up in Pennsylvania in a cabin. It's like, they still have it. That's where I sort of wrote Witches. And he made a comment about, I was saying something about like, we don't want to walk like right on the side of the road because cars are coming by. And he was like, that's what happened to my dad. And I remember it was like, and then it was like, well, what do you mean that your dad was hit by a car or a van? And he was like, yeah. And he was very funny about it because I think he assumes that people know ahead of time. And he was kind of like, you know, Scott, my name's Owen King. I'm from Maine. And I look a lot like my dad, and this is this. And I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. You know what I mean? And so it was.
It would have been funny if you still just looked at him blankly and were like, I don't get it.
Well, and also, like, I mean, it was one of the funny things that I think I was embarrassed about when we first met was that I was always like, I mean, I was a big Stephen King fan, and I always wore that on my sleeve in some ways too. So I think it was like a funny realization, and then being like, okay, well, this is my friend, and that's a separate thing entirely.
Right.
And it was great. I mean, what you realize with, and you know, I became friends with Joe Hill, his brother as well. I mean, more tangentially, I know Joe and we're friendly, but it's more, Owen is a deep friend. Sure. Like Owen, yeah. I consider him like, you know, we don't see each other that often, but I saw him last year over the last summer, and he's family to me. They're just wonderful about like their relationship to their, I think their sort of heritage, their writerly heritage, and also forging really independent paths where they're doing amazing work in their own right. And it's a really difficult thing, I'm sure, to navigate. And I think they do an incredible job. So yes, it's funny again, just because like my whole sort of relationship to Stephen King as a writer I admire predates obviously like, well, you know, all of that stuff. And it was just wild to suddenly be like, have a connection in some way to him in real life.
That's crazy. Yeah. We've tried to get Joe on the show before a couple of times, but he's not interested, you know, very politely declined. We haven't inquired about Owen. But we also kind of feel like, well, maybe we should not be like
asking his family to come on the show.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we don't want to be like overstepping, and it must be weird for anyone like to be like, hey, we have a podcast about your dad. You want to talk about your dad? Like, I understand it. Completely, but we love all of these people.
And funnily enough, when we had Stephen King himself on the show, the one person he was like, "Hey, you should try to get him on the show," was Owen. He mentioned Owen specifically because
I think having a legacy like that, you know, you forge your own relationship to it. And I think one of the things that I admire about that, everybody in that family, Joe and Owen, is the way that they've kind of found their way and made an incredible literary life, both of them celebrated and independent and all of it.
And uniquely their own voices as well.
Uniquely their own entirely. And also have, you know, figured out a way to sort of navigate that with incredible grace. And so I think they have different approaches, and, you know, that's great. And I think, again, like, I would encourage everybody out here to pick up their work, like, you know, they're incredible writers in their own right. And I think they have some incredible, just real masterpieces out there.
Agreed. Agreed.
We were talking off mic beforehand about our first encounter, which was on a cruise ship, and I really want to have that conversation, but I also know that we have a limited amount of time. So let's roll that into telling us a little bit about the book that you have coming out today. There are some similarities. So it turns out the first time that I've known of your work obviously for a long time, but like I actually met you through our mutual friend Charles Soule while we were doing this weird floating Comic-Con thing. Was that 2019, 2018, somewhere around there?
I think it was even before that, but yeah.
Oh, really? Because it was right after season one or season two of Stranger Things. That was like the big thing on the boat. All the kids from Stranger Things showed up for like a day or something. But it was such a weird fucking experience. And I found out that like talking to you, before we started recording that actually kind of impacted the work that you're releasing now. So do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so everybody out there, they decided they were going to do a comic book convention at sea on the cruise ship, and they called it Fan to Sea. And I remember it was like they had a lot of creators that I loved, Charles and Brian Azzarello and Gail Simone and Frank Miller stopped by. And it was this great sort of fun idea where they were like, you can bring your family on this cruise and it will be a convention. But I think the thing that was kind of also like looming in the back of our minds was like a convention, you know, they come and meet you once, and like someone comes like one day on a Friday and then they don't come back on a Saturday, or they come on a Saturday, but they're not like in a space with you for 4 days or 5 days consistently where it's like the mystique rubs off. You know what I mean? Like I've already signed your stuff. You're seeing me in my glasses and my sweatpants. Like it sort of like ruins the whole thing, you know, in some way, but it was like, I don't care. It's a free cruise. I'm taking my kids and whatever. But it wound up sort of being that, where the first day we went and they had like a convention on the upper floors and it was a lot of fun and people came and waited in line and got stuff signed. And then by the second day, it was like less. And then the third day, you're like just seeing them at the buffet. It's sort of like, yeah, we're here. And I just remember they filled the boat, or they were filling the boat also with people that were called like cruisers. And this was like a culture that I knew nothing about. And I was fascinated. I love Florida. I like worked at Disney World after college. And I'm fascinated by like the strangeness of that state. But so cruisers are people that like live in areas where cruise ships depart from and basically live on cruise ships, where they will rent or have a very small apartment, but they've cruised so many times that they're invited by those companies to fill any slots on cruise ships every week of their life, essentially for a very little amount of money. So they'll wind up paying like a couple $100 a week and then, or whatever of a month and, you know, $800 a month and going on amazing cruise ships or huge ships all over the world. And so they live for this. And so we were there on this ship and like, it was like the third or fourth day. And you were like, everybody had like run out of things to talk to each other about in terms of fans and creators. There was no, you know, and a con is also full of other crazy shit, right? There's also like Renaissance people and like lightsaber makers and, you know, that, and there's none of that here. It's just sort of like you get, so, and you know, you have the creators and the fans and that's it. And so these people were there and they were amazing. And they were like, basically, I remember they're mostly old, you know, elderly. And we were talking to a few of them and they were like, I can't wait for the cosplay party. We were on one right before this that was a heavy metal theme cruise. And we're on one right afterwards that's a anime cruise. And I was like,
Christ almighty.
I love your life. Like, I want to be you when I am 70, whatever. And they were like, ready for the cosplay. Am I doing it right? And one of them was a guy had like a sheet. He was like, I'm a ghost, you know? And the woman was like, I'm a cat. And I was like, you're doing just fine. Like, it was like completely not cosplay at all. But it was like, you know what? You're great. You're good. So the whole experience was very funny because it was like, it had this like kind of, I loved it, but I feel bad saying it, but it had this like Arab doom kind of around it from the beginning.
You could tell it wasn't going to work out when you were walking around, and largely because the con part of it. Like they sold like a third maybe of the tickets that they needed to sell to fill the boat, which is why the rest were filled with retirees and just like young Floridian party animal kind of people.
Yes,
there was a who lot were of absolutely anti the Comic-Con aesthetic. And
hey, I loved it. Like, it was also funny because it was like the Stranger Things kids were on the boat. So it was, and they were kids at that time. So you're always like, oh no, like protect them from this crazy, because there were like the young Floridian, like party animals, and the old people who were also party animals. And then there was also like, I love like Michael Rooker was on that one. And he's always a party animal. I love him. I've seen him at many cons, like jumping off the balcony into the pool and that. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, it was just such a funny, I loved it. So, I mean, I would totally do it again, but I think the memory I have was like, it was like they had an ice sculpture of the Hulk or something like that. Do you remember this? It was like something. And by like the third day, it was like melting.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where you were like, this is exactly what this is in like a great way.
Yeah, there's no other experience where I went from moderating a panel with a production designer of Stranger Things to introducing an on the deck poolside screening of Jaws to three people who were actually there to pay attention. Everybody else was there to grab ass and drink at the bar, right?
And we got to play craps and all.
Yeah, we played craps. You know, I got on a hot streak on craps. Yes. You know, yes. I made you a little bit of money, and now you're paying it forward by coming on the show. So
that's I know we're talking about everything else, but like craps is my absolute like weakness. Whenever like I went to school in Providence for college, and my best friend at that time, one of my best friends, like went to school in Wesleyan in Middleton, and we would meet in the middle at the casinos sometimes for fun. And they were really early years of those, so they weren't what they are now. But it was like you go to Foxwoods, and then if you like lost, you'd go to Mohegan Sun, where it was like way crappier at that time. Uh-huh. And the music was free at Mohegan Sun's in this place called the Wolf's Den. So like, it was like, if you won anything, you would stay and watch like James Brown or, you know, Nancy Wilson at Foxwoods. And if you lost, you would like go see Lou Rawls at Mohegan Sun. And I love Lou Rawls. Don't get me wrong.
Right,
that was like
right.
One of the best shows ever. You know, Tobacco Road, the whole thing, but it was like that. So craps to me is the most fun game, because essentially you're like betting on people where you're all in it together at the table, right? Because if you don't know how to play craps, if you're out there, essentially the basic rule is like you're rolling the dice, and whatever number you get, a 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, you're trying to get that number again before you get a 7. And everybody at the table essentially is betting that you do that too. So 7 is the easiest number to make, right? So they're all on your side, hoping you defy the odds and win together. And so I love the spirit of that, you know, seeing somebody and being like, you look like you had a really shitty day, but I'm betting on you. Like, we're going to get a 4 again before we get a 7 together today, because that's who we are today in this casino. So yeah. Let's do it.
Anyway. Yeah, if you've ever walked around a casino and heard people absolutely lose their fucking minds, 9 times out of 10, it's a craps table.
It's a special thing. I believe in it. Communal. I love craps. Yes.
But we do have a little bit of a heart out with you. So sorry if we're rushing through all this.
No,
stuff.
Let's do it.
Tell us. We need to get to your Stephen King origin story, but I want you. Please God, pimp your book that you're here to promote.
I'm technically here to promote, but I'm honestly here like I'm excited to be here with you guys to talk about the great work of Stephen King. But yes, I have a book coming out from a publisher in comics called Distillery. What I love about the company is that it allows the creators that sort of were the first people in the door with them to invest in the company itself. So right. it's basically me and a bunch of other creators that I love. And if you know comics, you probably know them. Jock, who I worked with on Witches and Black Mirror, and James Tynan, who's like the reigning king of comics and is amazing, does tons of horror stuff. And a whole number of other people that do a lot of horror, but also all kinds of fantastic comics. Have sort of, you know, we're in it together, where we've invested in the company and in each other, and it's us making the comics that we want. So my book, White Boat, I'm working with Francesco Francavilla, who I did another horror book with a couple years ago called Night of the Ghoul, about like a lost horror movie from the 30s, a fictionalized lost horror movie from the 30s that was burned up in a studio fire, but it's supposed to be like the greatest horror movie of all time. And a guy who's tracking down the story of it and winds up finding the director still alive in a hospice. And the director is sort of like, well, I'm glad you found me, but the ghoul is alive and here in this building and now we're all dead. And so it's a fun that. And so Francesco and I have a very deep love of classic horror. And so this is almost our take on a modernized version of something like The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Wow.
Where what it's about is a guy who's has who's out on the sea with his father and his brother, his twin brother. His name is Lee. And his brother's name is Ward. His mother loved the ocean and named them Leeward, which is the side of a boat that faces shelter. And the boat is hit by a rogue wave. It's a small fishing boat and his brother drowns. And he always feels very guilty because he and his brother were arguing over who gets the top bunk and his brother let him have it. And that's why his brother sort of passed away with the boat. And he's never done anything with his life. And he kind of writes about, he never leaves the ocean though. And he writes about yachts and expensive boats, even though he hates it. And he's just drinks too much and all of this. And then one day he gets invited mysteriously to review this boat that's supposed to be the most expensive yacht ever made. Nobody knows who owns it. Nobody knows what its functionality is, but it's called the White Boat. White boats are the sort of generic term for super yachts, but it's called the White Boat. And he goes on, and as soon as he gets on there, very strange and scary things start happening. And it takes off without telling him it was going to take off, and he can't get off of it. And so it begins like a haunted, not a haunted, but like more of a really paranoid story as it takes him to this island where terrible things have been happening. And it connects back to his story from childhood. So I really love it. I love working with Francesco. I hope you'll check it out. It's out right now. And yeah, it's like a big, the way Distillery does books is they're like big 45 page issues. So it's three big issues. And the first one's out now. Yeah.
Awesome. So yeah, we should get to your Stephen King origin story here, Scott. I'm going to have to go Scott S. This is, we're doing elementary school rules, Scott S and Scott W. Oddly enough, I think that you, both of the Scott's origin stories are fairly similar. If the origin story on your Wikipedia is to be believed, does it involve Eyes of the Dragon? Is that the one that
it does? It really does. Like I was like 10, probably not, maybe 9. Yeah, because I went there for 4 years. Yeah, about 9, 10. And this is like back in the 80s. And my parents, they used to sort of offer for me to go to a sleepaway camp every year. And I feel like these don't really, I don't know if they exist anymore, but they were like 8 weeks long. And it was like, I went to one that was like all boys. And it was all sports. And I was like an arts and crafts kid. So all I did was like hide at arts and crafts all summer. I remember going and just being like so scared and anxious and all of this. And, you know, I was just a kid. And it was very sort of like macho and Lord of the Flies and very like, rah, 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 you know. Yeah. And I had this counselor named Ted. I still remember his name. He had like big curly hair and he played the guitar. He was sort of a hippie in like a jock world there.
Right. So the first or second one to die in a Friday the 13th scenario. It was
absolutely the first. But then for some reason, he was like, you know what, guys? Like every night I'm going to read to you from a book. And like for 8 weeks, like every night, like when it's time for canteen, which is, you know, the lights out, we're going to do that. And he had Eyes of the Dragon. And I remember like, I lived a lot of those days, like fearful of getting a basketball, you know, or like having somebody throw it to me or like all that stuff. But I really looked forward to going back to the bunk at the end of the day and listening to that story about Roland and Flag and, you know, all of it. And, it was the first time, I mean, I had liked comics and I had liked, you know, I'd read books and had things that I had liked, but it was really the first time that I was really mesmerized by, I think, one long sequential story over that kind of a period of time. He read this basically what I imagine was some truncated version of the whole book, but he read the whole book. Like he finished it, you know, last week of camp. And I remember just every day being like, whatever happened, I'm excited to go back and hear Ted read us from Eyes of the Dragon. And I still remember lying there. I remember like the feel of the bunk. I remember the shitty blanket. I remember like, you know, and everybody listened, like all the boys listened, you know, it was great. So that was my first like big, that was my first sort of Stephen King experience, you know, in that way that really got me hooked.
Yeah, Wampler had a very similar thing, but it was your grandmother, right, reading?
Yeah, my parents went out of town for a couple of weeks when I was very young, like 6 or 7 or something like that. And Eyes of the Dragon was a new release at that time. And she, like my mother had a copy of it, and my grandmother was reading it to me at night. And I don't think she finished it. But I think I finished it afterwards, and I was, yeah, you know, at that age, like super, super young. And that kickstarted the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know,
and yeah. Just, it was like that magic of being enveloped and immersed in a world where you just couldn't wait to get back. And I think that's one of the things that he did so well is not just tell a story, but create this incredibly sort of enveloping environment, you know, with everything, where even working with him on American Vampire was fascinating. So like the way all of that happened was that now by the time I was working in comics, like, you know, I had met him. He had, you know, been very kind to us with things. Like when I sold American Vampire, I was so excited. It was like one of the best days of my life, like to Vertigo in DC. And I was like a nobody to them, and it was for very little money and all that. But they said, like, do you know anyone in the horror world that would be willing to give you a blurb for the book that would help? And I was like, well, I know Stephen King. I've met Stephen King. And they were like, all right, well, go for it. And so I called him.
Throw that deck
and I emailed him. I emailed him and said, you know, do you mind? Like, would you be okay writing a line if you like it? Only if you like it, you know, like if you don't like it, I won't be offended. Like, and he read it and he wrote back saying, you know, I'd like to write an issue of this if you're up for it one day. And I was like, well, if I tell them that, they'll want you to write the first issue, not me. And, you know, like they would be happy to have you. And he's like, okay, well, just tell them, like, I'd be willing to write a little bit. And so I left them a message on like Friday afternoon after the office was closed at like 6, whatever. And then like, it was like a Monday morning at like 9 a.m., 9:01. I got a call from like everybody at DC that was like, did you just say that Stephen King would be willing to write some of American Empire? And one of the fascinating things with him was that working on American Vampire, he was technically only, you know, I knew he had so much on his plate, and the last thing I wanted to do was like, you know, burden him or whatever. So I was like, well, look, like I'll tell the story of Pearl, who's this woman who becomes a new kind of vampire in the 1920s. She's infected by this kind of mysterious guy who grew up in the Old West called Skinner Sweet. And it's the whole series is about different species of vampire. It posits that like the European kind, the Dracula kind, are only one species among like hundreds. And so I was like, I'll tell this story. And if you want to tell the story of Skinner Sweet, like here's the basic outline that we came up with. And, you know, do whatever you want. But like it's only, you know, a few pages an issue, and we'll spread it over the course of the first arc. So it was only going to be like 3 or 4 pages an issue from him. And then he started writing, and then he would write and be like, oh, I think I'm going off the res a little bit with this. And I would be like, okay, yeah, whatever you want. And then he wound up sending in a full script where it was like, this is way longer than anything we thought, way better, and like full of new, you know, all kinds of great ideas and characters. And what you realize reading it, the script, was that it wasn't only like a script. It was like he described things that wouldn't make it into the comic, and he used the language of the time here and there for effect, where he would be like, you know, this old wagon is busted, you know, and doesn't have a wheel, and it's in the background because it's, you know, telling us that people have come here for a long time and da 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 da. Right. And the thing that became evident was that he just lives in story, where he like goes into a story space. And there's no phoning it in. It's like he's living in that place and you know, is fully enmeshed in what he's creating. And it was so inspiring, honestly, because it was like, God, you know, he could write this in his sleep. I you know, and I gave him right. the markers. And instead it was like, no, he created something wonderful that was you know, wholly from his enthusiasm for the material. And it was right. just, it really was one of those moments when they're like, don't meet your heroes. But you're like this, you know, it was a lesson where it was like, never phone it in. You could, you know, always live in it. And it was amazing. And then of course they were like, he actually has like enough for, you know, five full issues. So it was unbelievable.
Go ahead.
What?
Yes, I'm sorry. Well, I was just going to say the man cannot help but create.
Yeah. And then the terror comes of like, this is amazing. We have like five issues about Skinner Sweet's origin by Stephen King that'll be in the back of the things I'm writing. And then you're like, oh my God, we have five issues by Stephen King. Mine suck. Like I am going, no one is going to want to read mine. They're only going to want to read his. And the second he's off the book, they're going to drop it. And so, I was very scary, but he was wonderful about being supportive of it. And, you know, we did well with it and I was very grateful to him.
Being able to creatively collaborate with somebody like King is such rarefied air. I hope you recognize that because it's like, Owen and Joe have done it. Peter Straub has done it.
Richard Chismar
has done it. But when it comes to writing, it very few other people have. Like they've collaborated with him on as a director on Maximum Overdrive or as a screenwriter on one of the projects or whatever. But even that's not the same thing because it's usually him turning over a script and then they rewrite it. You have somebody else rewrite it or something. You not only got to meet your hero, you got to, you know, you got to work with him. You know,
well, he makes it so natural and not intimidating. Like he was very much like, for example, like he took a work for hire pay. He asked what the lowest amount we could like legally pay him for it was. And he took no equity in it, no credit for anything. He worked as though he was working in comics as like a newbie off the street. And, you know, there's no reason for that. He could argue for ownership of many things as part of it, as a precursor for him coming in, he could say, if I write an issue, well, then I want producer credit on blah, blah. He didn't do anything like that. He was just like, you know, just having fun. And that makes it fun on this end too, because he's so, just so encouraging for young writers, new writers. You know, he'd always been that way in the literary world. Like, you know, again, he had, even offering to judge something like Best American Stories is an act of wanting to support people coming into the industry and mm-hmm. in a form that isn't, you know, commercial. He's just that person that I think is always, you know, very much trying to welcome people in. He gives blurbs to people. He's always there, you know, for someone new, and he's excited about the craft. And so, you know, working with him, he was very funny because he would write a script. And then I remember one time at the end, our vampires were very like, science-based in quotes, where it was like, you know, we didn't want anyone like, you know, with magical powers or any of that. It was supposed to be all about blood and cells and different genealogies and heritage. And so at the end of an issue, he'd be like, and then Skinner Sweet turns into a bat and flies away. And I was like, oh no, like shit. Now I have to tell Stephen King, our vampires don't act that way. And like, how am I going to do this? Like, so you know, what am I going to do? And like, nobody at DC wanted to give him the note. You know what I mean? So I'd be like, oh, hello, you know, hey, see you. It's Scott. And like, you know, our vampires just, I don't know. I love what you did, but you know, they don't turn into bats. And he was like, I was just fucking with you. And then he'd be like, here's the real ending. And it was like, literally like just like a totally great normal ending for our series. But he did it twice. He had somebody turn into mist also once, and then he did this. I fell for it twice where I was like, oh no. But that's what I mean. He makes it really fun, and I know it's always intimidating obviously, but he was just great, you know. I have not anything to say, but like, you know, however you think he is in terms of being supportive and being, you know, like encouraging, multiply that and be like, that's who he really is. So
I think he's a real like salt of the earth, down home motherfucker. Like, I think he cares about the money in the same way that we all care about the money. You know, like you want to get paid. But I also feel like if you go up to Bangor and visit that area, and you find out the sheer amount of money that he and Tabby have invested in that town, you know, like revitalizing a library, building a little league field, and a fucking, I think a water park too. Yeah, like they're cool, just, yeah. You know, it's, I think one of the coolest things about Stephen King is that he has more money than God, and he still is out here like doing supportive shit for people, you know,
that's the way I always have seen him. And he's open about the things he believes in, whether yes. it costs him readers or not. And I just admire everything like that. And that's the way he's raised his children. And I feel like, you know, it's very evident. Like everyone has.
Yeah. He's a really great. He's a role model for fame.
Oh yeah. There's tea you could spill and be like, actually, he was such an asshole.
In blue jeans and a fucking baseball cap and just to hang out, you know.
And he's like, and he's so smart about though too, just about like, you know, because he can be really funny. I know he's always like, oh, I'm the hamburger, and but he's not at all. He's like a master craftsman, and you know he'll be funny where you're like. I remember, you know, seeing him speak at this thing at the New Yorker Festival with friends and that, and like, and they were like, how do you know when a story's over? And he's like, when everybody's dead, and like everybody laughs and that. But, you know, you think about the achievement of what he has done, and also at core, how transformative like his writing is. And like what he does is he takes all of these things that are this safe, the things that we take safety and refuge in American iconography, right? Your father, mm-hmm. your family dog, mm-hmm. your classic car, all those things, your small town in Salem's Lot, all of it. Like, and then those things become the point of fear. It's not, you know, oh, something from an exotic foreign country in some way. Sure, you know, what's his name? Barlow is from somewhere else, but he's not. Scary thing. The scary thing is Ralphie and those, you know, like the
right,
you know, Danny. That same thing. It's making these things that make you feel safe. Seeing the horror in that, that's so, you know, it's revolutionary in my opinion. In the 70s and 80s, taking at a moment when people are worried about American decline and are trying to be patriotic in all these ways and find meaning in all these old symbols from the 50s, and taking them and making a point of horror makes you look at things and really question and be scared and in really primal ways. And that, you know, that's like an achievement that I think sometimes doesn't get like, you know, he doesn't get the credit for a, like not just a kind of horror that he invented, or, you know, that where it's like, oh, it's the writer and it's, you know, not invented because, you know, there's Poe and whatever. But I just mean.
Yeah, but
that thing, that holy American, that inversion where it's like the things that we hold dear and think can't be scary are the points of horror. That thing is so powerful, you know, and there've mm-hmm. been so many imitators of it. But that at core is like, you know, it's different. Like classic horror is like strange and things coming from somewhere else and aliens and this and that, and he makes it wholly the things that you're like, well, this will be the safe thing, and that thing is the scary thing, you know.
I think like a key to King's success is the universality of his writing, that you can absolutely imagine yourself in this position, you know, whatever his lead character is, and then you can buy into the reality, whatever reality he might be selling at that time, right?
Yeah.
That's a thing that I think a lot of authors struggle with. You know, you can write great genre stories that have a specific point of view, but King is doing something slightly different. Like it's genre stuff, but you can absolutely insert yourself into it. I can't necessarily do that in, say, a sci-fi thing or a particular sort of Western, but he's playing on universal fears. And then on top of that, bringing you in like a little thing. Like this is so tiny, but using brand names in his stories.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, it was like, well, he's pimping these brands or whatever. No, but you know, you and I don't go to the refrigerator to get a can of soda and call it a can of soda. It's like I went to the fridge and got a Pepsi, you know, yeah. Or that's whatever what it is.
Makes like, it every day, like yeah, really scary yeah. in that way. Where looking at Night Shift, for example, where you know One for the Road is from, that book, I have the first edition of that book on my shelf over here. My wife got it for me. She gets me, in fact, like she's bought me a few Stephen King first editions. Like over the years, I have Pet Sematary and then uh-huh. like, for Christmas. But like that book, I remember reading it and it was like all these things like trucks, Children of the Corn, like mm-hmm. all these things that are so American in their iconography becoming frightening, you know, and right. you're right about right. the characters too, like Ben Mears in Salem's Lot or Booth in One for the Road, like you relate to them entirely. So having the horror come into their lives in ways that you don't expect, you know, Needful Things, all of it, you're like, it's very particular to his writing, you know, like when you think about what in the 60s was scary or considered scary, you know, you see it coming in at the same time he becomes popular with you know, first with Hitchcock and then with Toby Hooper and those things. Mm-hmm. But it was part of what, you know, that's where he's from, is that thing of writing about people that you would know, a town you could recognize, the things that you feel horror wouldn't happen here. And then all of a sudden absolutely. There it is.
Yes.
Yep. Yep. That became kind of his bread and butter. And I think a lot of it is him being able to fill, it's not filler, but you're getting intimate looks at people's lives before the action, right? It's not just
it's relatability of the story, you know.
Yeah, it's he makes the mundane interesting, and then also by doing so makes it feel like something you recognize. So once you're in the horror shit, then you're feeling it more viscerally. Yeah, yeah, it's
exactly.
Yeah, it. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, we.
It's a feeling I don't get if I read necessarily like Clive Barker. Like I can't always put myself in the shoes of Clive Barker's characters, or you know, to use a more, well,
it's because yeah, the emotion, I mean, the scariest book, I thought about doing Pet Sematary, but it's like I feel like you know, it's so talked about, but it's the scariest book I ever read. And I think as a kind of as a crystallization of the thing that he does so well with character and also identification, like you're saying, what's scary about all of his stuff to me is that you relate to the person doing the thing that's causing the horror to happen. So like you can imagine yeah. like yeah. being like, I still love my car, even though I know it's this because of these bullies. You can imagine being like, you know what? I lost my kid. I am burying him in that cemetery and I don't care if he comes back bad. And it takes so much effort and good writing to get you to identify that deeply with a character. Even in this story too, like, what makes it special to me is like Booth and Tukey, you know, they're old men and they have regrets and they have this one safe space. And then all of a sudden this thing happens. Like, but it's there in all of his work. Like it's never feels like we were saying with American Vampire, like he lives in the story. It's never phoned in. It's always creating an emotional attachment to a character and then feeling that horror experientially with them because of the things they're struggling with in their lives.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned One for the Road, which is the story you picked. I have two questions for you here. One, can you kind of give a brief description of what the story is for people in case it might not be at the top of their minds? And two, why this story out of everything that you could have talked about? Why did this one jump out to you?
Yeah, well, so it's a short story in Night Shift, which is one of my absolute favorite King books. And I read it. I was probably, you know, it was the year I was back from that sleepaway camp. So I was probably 11, I guess, or so, 10, 11. And I read the whole book and this story really stuck out to me. I'll get into why in a second. But so what it's about, it's sort of a sequel to Jerusalem's Lot, to Salem's Lot. And I hadn't read that at the time. So this was my first exposure to that whole kind of vampire mythology. But it takes place just outside of Jerusalem's, outside Salem's Lot, after the events of that book. And it's essentially just a small story about a bar called Tukey's Bar on the night of a snowstorm. And it's a bunch of kind of old men who've grown up in Maine in that area sitting around. And all of a sudden, a guy stumbles in from the snow. His name is Gerald Lumley. And he's frantic because he left his wife and his daughter, his young daughter, in the car after it plowed into a snowdrift to go find help. And they're running out of gas, and he's worried the car is going to go cold and they're going to die. And so, of course, Booth, the main character, and his friend Tukey, who's the owner of the bar, decide to go out and help. But what they learn is that he took a turn off towards a place called Salem's Lot, and that's where the car broke down. And so there's this palpable feeling of dread. And as they get closer, they start seeing red eyes out in the darkness and shapes slinking away. And it becomes clear that this is an area that everyone in town knows is infested with vampires. And they warn Lumley, if we find the car and there's nobody in it, we're turning around. And he's like, why would there be nobody in it? You know, that why would my wife and daughter wouldn't go out in the snowstorm like this? And so of course they get there and there is nobody in the car. And Lumley won't hear anything about turning around. And they try and warn him that it's a place that's infested with vampires. He doesn't believe them, of course. And he goes looking for, and unfortunately finds his wife, Francine, and his Janie and his daughter, Francine. And both of them have been turned into vampires. And I don't know how much I should spoil. Should I go all the way to the end or no?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So
in 4 decades.
He finds his wife, and it's narrated from Booth, one of the old men, and he's watching Lumley go towards this beautiful woman out in the snow. And of course, she looks up and she's got red eyes and fangs, and she takes him down, and Tukey and Booth run back to the car. And as they're about to jump in, the little girl is standing there, and she asks Booth to pick her up because she's so cold, and she wants to give him a kiss for finding her. And he starts to fall for it, but at the last minute, his friend Tukey throws a Bible at her, and he hisses and disappears into the darkness. And then it has this kind of coda where he talks about how they found the car the next day, and nobody knew, you know, they didn't really tell anyone what happened to Lumley because people around there know anyway, and there's no real use in it. Now and then a hiker would go missing and that, but for the most part, everyone just stays away from Jerusalem, from Salem's Lot. And he says, you know, if you ever come up and visit this town, I would advise you to just, you know, you could stop at Tukey's. It's still a nice place, even though he died a little while ago. They've kept it much the same, and I don't go there that often. But what I tell you is just keep driving and don't stop. Don't turn off, especially if it's night, because there's a little girl out there still waiting for her goodnight kiss. And that line hit me so much when I was that age, too. I mean, the whole story had me riveted, but it was really the ending that caught me. I mean, I remember just kind of keep trying to emulate that, as I wanted to be a writer at that time, or starting to want to be a writer, to emulate that kind of last line in some of my stuff. Mm-hmm. We're trying to rip it off, make it my own, all of that. But it really sent chills up my spine, you know? And I think the thing that I loved about the story, even if I didn't really understand it too, was this terrible feeling where of dread, where everybody in the town has accepted this horrible thing. It's there and part of the kind of environment. And they've come to live with it. And there's something that goes beautifully hand in hand with this idea of the bar and the main characters being this group of old men who have also they're sort of dreading death. There's a great line in it about from Booth, the narrator, about how he loves to come to a place like this where the voices are just loud enough to drown out like the death beetles and that stuff, but not, you know, too loud. And so that that feeling of being at the end of your life or towards the end of your life and knowing something is coming, you know, death is coming, and also the acceptance that they have for this really dark thing that's at the edge of town, at the edge of where they live, and right. And just sort of not looking at it, avoiding it. You know, there's a great parallel in there.
Yeah.
I got to thank you for picking this short story, because we've talked about it on the show, and I was telling Vespi about this before we recorded, but I read this story, I knew what it was, and was able to have a conversation about it without necessarily revisiting it. And I reread it this morning and was really truly caught off guard by it. It's, for starters, I'm not a huge fan of Salem's Lot, which is largely due to the fact that I'm not really into vampire stuff. You know, I'm with apologies to American Nightmare, which, by the way, which, you know, we read it and talked about it on the show. Yeah, it's I did enjoy that. But like, typically, like for monster stuff, I'm not, you know, a big vampire guy. And I thought rereading this today, two things hit me about it. One is that it's genuinely frightening. Vespi and I read so much horror, we watch so much horror, that I think he will agree with me when I say that it takes something special to unnerve you if at that point. Like, if you're just saturated in this stuff, you know, you don't see, you see movies that are a good horror movie, but not, they don't necessarily frighten you. I found this story legitimately frightening when I was revisiting it this morning.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with this one for me too, is there's this sort of this sense of anxiety around it, where you know it's going to get awful, you know, from very early on. And it's got that kind of ghost story trope about like sitting around a fire in this cozy place and somebody runs in from the storm with like a horrible tale to tell, or, you know, and seems haunted by what happened. And so it has this like classic feel, but it's really modern. And just like you said, he even spends in that very first paragraph time personifying the bar, describing sort of the town, describing the characters. From the very beginning, you get a sense that this isn't sort of a conventional sort of ghost story or an exercise. It feels lived in, it feels warm, and he makes you not want to leave just by describing the wind and the snow and all the stuff that you don't want to feel outside.
Well, that's,
so you know, you're going out there, you know?
Yes, that's the other thing. It's the sense of place that this story has. It feels immersive, for lack of a better word. You feel the cold of the snow, the way he describes it, the way it strikes up against the side of a car, the haze of it when you're driving in it. I've never lived anywhere with snow, and I kind of romanticize the idea of living somewhere with snow. And Lord help me, I would love to move up to New England, in that area, and try to deal with this stuff. But reading this, it reinvigorated that thought that, like, that's an area of the country I feel like I kind of belong in, but also like I crave that sort of that coldness and the snow of it all. It's remarkably evocative for King at this point in his career. I think it's just really, really well written. Those are my two points.
Yeah, I think so too. And I mean, I think, again, to write when you're young, a character that's old that well, also, you know, looking back just as a writer at this point, I didn't really pick up on it at that time because I, you know, was less aware of like his age and that. But there's a sense of sadness, a sense of loneliness, a sense of kind of acceptance of things that are dark and that almost shouldn't be accepted, I think, in Booth, and a sadness to all of it too, that's makes it so much more powerful, you know. And then there's also just the willingness to go to the darkest possible place. Like when you read Pet Sematary or this or Boogeyman or some of the real, you know, the brutal stuff, Cujo as well, where, you know, that was the thing that really hit me with some of the first horror things that really, scared me. I mean, for me, the first movie, I've said it before, but the first horror movie that really scared me was Night of the Living Dead. And we had a video store where I was growing up that wouldn't rent R-rated horror movies or R-rated movies to kids, but they would like deliver them to your house. And so it was like a neighborhood secret, and all of us would get all the terrible slasher movies and Faces of Death with Edward Gross and all that stuff. And then one day I got Night of the Living Dead, and I didn't realize it was black and white. And I like popped it in and was like, oh, this is terrible. My friends are all going to hate it. But I watched it and I didn't understand. Like, it really bothered me, and I didn't understand it at the time. And I decided I like hated the movie, and it was that, but I kept coming back to it, and it really gave me like a sense of anxiety at night. I had real bad worries about death and all of this from it. And it came to be like my favorite horror movie after a while. So what I realized was like, it was the first time I had ever really watch something where everybody I thought was going to make it out, the young couple, Barbara, Ben, everybody in that movie, spoiler, but it's like 60 years old, so you've had a lot of time to watch it.
Yeah.
Like everybody dies, and everybody dies because of this failing of collectivism of this group to survive the zombies who are slow mm-hmm. and easily survivable by not being able to get along. Like they just can't do it. And it's so much about that moment in the 60s and all of those things. But at core, it was one that just hit me because it went to this place where I didn't expect it to go emotionally, where even the family in the basement, you know, the daughter who zombies out and kills her parents, everything was brutal. And that's what I love too about Stephen King's work is that if it makes emotional sense and if it's what the story demands mm-hmm. and it's what it's about, he'll go to the darkest place possible, like this or the boogeyman or that, where you'll show up and the person you think he's going to find, the daughter, is not only not going to survive, but is the point of evil and still out there is the scariest thing. So I love mm-hmm. that as a sense of priority, you know, an announcement of those priorities in this short story. For me, I mean, as a reader, it was one of the first time that I encountered that kind of thing as a kid, because I skipped around in the book. I read this before I read the first story, Jerusalem's Lot, which is like the prequel to Salem's right. Lot.
What do you make of that?
Oh, that story?
Yeah.
I mean, I think when I read it, it was a little bit above my head because it has that epistolary format and it has that sure. kind of antiquated feel. But I love that story too. I mean, I like the idea. I think it was the first time I encountered, and I touched on this actually in American Vampire, the idea of the devil or something satanic as the worm. That was what I remember really well about that. This idea of this horrible twisting yes. worm thing beneath the town being called forth and being almost like this larval infectious thing.
Lovecraftian.
That was what really scared me about that one. You know, that feeling of something dark and almost Lovecraftian in the sense of like a worm.
As, you know, Bespy asked earlier, but I'm curious now, like you could have picked anything. Why this one? Like you could have done Jerusalem's Lot too. You could have done Salem's Lot. You could have done anything fucking really, but like why this particular story?
Well, this one to me was just like a perfect, I think, you know, again, it's the first time I encountered sort of vampires in the Stephen King mythology. And I read it. It was one of the first stories I read after Eyes of the Dragons. So it was very early in my, like, you know, not just Stephen King reading, but reading for pleasure phase of being like a boy. And I just think it's a perfect construction, honestly. Like, it plays on it and it brings to mind all these things that I think that he does so well. Like I was saying earlier, where on the one hand, it takes this classic form. It has this kind of, I'm telling you a tale, come close. I'm telling you about something I shouldn't tell you about, this one night that changed my life. Like that format immediately brings to mind Edgar Allan Poe and all kinds of like, you know, classic sort of horror. But it has that perfectly Stephen King thing where it's immediately about a sense of place, about how he starts talking about the guy plowing outside and the snowstorm and the town and Tukey and all of that stuff. And so it makes it something that's, like you said, has this sense of environment, has this sense of immersive kind of location and all that stuff. And then from there, it goes into the emotionality of the main character. He talks about how he doesn't want to be alone, how he loves the voices in this place because, you know, it's like a clean, well-lighted place in a way. It's like he's afraid of death. He's afraid of what's out there, you know, what's coming for him in some way, not even in a scary, monstrous, supernatural way, but the fact that he's older and he's in his 70s and he knows his friends won't be around that long and he's lost his wife. And then from there, it gets into the real horror where all of a sudden it's like everyone knows you're going to some bad place and what you see there is going to be even worse than you expect. And it follows that all the way through and it goes to the place that, you know, I didn't think it would go. I've never, like, it was definitely in the same zone as seeing Night of the Living Dead at that time, right around the same time where my first encounters with horror that was sort of would go past the boundary of what I had experienced as a kid. But then strangely earned that, you know, where you realize it's not upsetting and salacious just to be shocking. It has a point that's emotional and psychological and intellectual sometimes. And you're like, wow, that really, hit me in a different way, you know? Those are my favorite things, honestly, like both in fiction and film and all of it, the kind of horror that takes you to a place that pushes past the place you think it was going to go, but has it, like, earns that that real transgressive kind of take.
We've talked a little bit about the whole angle on this thing about the locals knowing what's up, right? And not making eye contact with it, right? They just know that that's a bad zone. They don't go in there. I love that. That's like the cornerstone of like American Werewolf in London's another piece of fiction that uses that, right? Where it's that original town, you know, the townsfolk, they know there's werewolves out there. They just stay in their pub. And then these interlopers come in and fuck it all up. Right.
Yep.
You know, I love that thing of just like, yep, there are just pockets where supernatural's just known and accepted. And the way humanity deals with it is they don't grab a giant, they don't form a giant army. They don't call the government and get the National Guard in there. They just go on with business as usual and just try to avoid that area, you know, which feels so right to me and how humans deal with problems, you know?
I mean, I think also like, well, going off of what you said, because, you know, for me, again, the scariness of having something that you think you're going to find safety in, right? Like the mother, the wife, I mean, and the young girl, and having those be the things that are the scariest in the story. Have the girl, the little kid, without a coat that you feel bad for because she's out in the snow and you're worried about her and you're hoping they find her in time, become the thing that's the last and scariest element of the whole story, to me, is like classic King. You know, it's, again, it's that desire to push a story to a place that's brutal, but not, again, to be shocking. It feels like this is what, you know, Booth is most afraid of. Like, there are things beyond the periphery of his vision out in the dark that he doesn't want to look at, about his age, about his life, about his regrets. And that's why he feels comfortable with Tukey and comfortable in this like warm bar in the middle of winter instead of in his own house. And yet, like, this story is sort of about, like, you know, the desire to be a good person and try and be brave and face those things, face to scary things, you know, with dignity, and then going out there and seeing something that makes you feel like I'm never doing it again because it's that frightening. You know, some things can't be
right.
Can't be faced.
Let me ask you this. You know, Jerusalem's Lot is the prequel. Salem's Lot's the backbone. This is the sequel to that novel. What do you think becomes of the Lot after this story?
Like, oh, I think it's still there. I love thinking of Salem's Lot as there. I mean, I love this abandoned, you know,
like burned out fucking town.
Yes, burned out. Because, I mean, that's one of my favorite openings and closings is Salem's Lot, you know, where Ben is with Mark out in the beach in Mexico and still gets the paper delivered about the town and then goes back at the end. You know, that sense of like he's gonna take it down and burn it, even though they could just stay away. You know, so I love the idea of this thing that, you know, is still out there and that all the locals just avoid. I feel like that has such power, you know, and certainly in some of the stuff that I've done, like witches and that, I know that it was in the back of my mind as an inspiration.
I'm reminded of the, God, we were, for some reason, this came up on another episode that we did like somewhere within the last 6 months, but I'm thinking about the town that Silent Hill is based on.
You know, oh, yeah.
The place that with the fire burning underneath it. Like,
yeah, because of the mine. Yeah.
Yeah. And like my immediate thought on Salem's Lot is like, well, surely someone would come along and attempt to rebuild or like revitalize the town or whatever the fuck, you know, clear it out and take the property or something like that. But then also I'm thinking, yeah, but in real life, this town has been burning for fucking 60 years. So maybe not, you know, maybe it is just sitting there on the map, like a trap waiting for anyone that happens to wander into it.
Well, and also I think, you know, there's something to it. Like, again, there's just power in the mythology, you know, knowing that he was writing in the 70s at a moment when people are leaving, you know, towns and cities for suburbs in different ways. And places that are sort of classic small towns and industrial areas like in Maine and other places are sort of going through challenging times, and there's a sense of decline in the 70s, and then making those places haunted and scary, you know, and places that come back to get you. There's power in that too. It's like, you know, in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the idea of like the South as this thing coming back to get you for being forgotten and all of that. Like, it feels like he's, I love the idea of the town as this thing that's out there waiting for you. Even if it's burned down, it's still there. And we're somehow all complicit in it, you know, or guilty. Just knowing it's there and not, and it just avoiding it, like the Babadook or that kind of thing. I love that sort of stuff, you know?
I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about vampires. Now that we've established one of us is more a fan than the other. When you were a kid, is this your favorite kind of monster? Versus probably, a wolfman or a gillman or Frank.
Yeah, it is. I mean, vampires are my favorite in terms of that. Like, I think zombies have made some of my favorite stories, but as an actual monster, I don't find the monster to have a ton of potential. Like, I've never been super interested in writing about them. Whereas the thing that scares me about vampires, or I've always loved since this story and Salem's Lot, and then some of the stuff in the 80s, like Lost Boys and Near Dark and that stuff, was that it feels like, you know, when they're done in a really scary way, it's the people that you know and love turned into these evil things that are back from the dead coming to get you. And so they know everything about you. It's that, you know, Ralphie at the window being like, open the door, you know, and you know, they're like, here, the wife, either Janie or Francine, I don't remember which name is the wife, but
Francine,
you know, calling and being like, oh, come here, honey, come here. And they're themselves, and yet they're really evil and scary. So there's something really deeply frightening about the notion of like the people that love you most being turned into evil, predatory, animalistic versions of themselves that still possess all of the intelligence and the manipulative abilities of, like, you know, the person they were, like, knowing all those things, knowing your childhood, knowing your, all of it. So I've always loved vampires for that reason, something that goes away and comes back as an evil version of itself. It's why I love Salem's Lot too, like, in that way, because they don't come back zombies, you know, they come back something much worse.
You know, you mentioned that zombies have led to some of your favorite stories, and I'm curious what you think it is about the zombie genre that does lend itself to, you know, often very rich stories. I don't get that from, say, the Wolfman genre, right? Like, and even with vampires, I don't necessarily get that. I feel like we get the same kind of flavor of vampires a lot, which is why I start paying attention when, you know, it's American, like with American Vampire, it's a Western, like, that's interesting. But, you know, like goth, sexy folks just kind of like mugging down on each other. Like, I've seen this a billion fucking times, but
yeah, that doesn't interest me, honestly, that kind of vampire.
But zombies, like zombies seem to create the, like, an atmosphere that allows for what I would say are more involved or richer stories. Do you agree? And if so, like, why?
Well, I guess I wouldn't necessarily sort of, I don't know. I don't know that I have more favorite zombie stories than vampire stories or anything like that. But I think that the thing is that zombies, I think the appeal in the last 15 or years in particular, and then also the appeal and the moments that they've been really popular, is like, you know, they offer like the acute sense of apocalypse suddenly, where all of a sudden, like, you know, that something has been triggered that we all feel could happen, you know, like in these days where you feel this palpable anxiety about everything from like pandemics to civil war to, you know, catastrophic like events, that the zombies become the personification of that. And then in that way, they allow you to tell really dark stories about people. I mean, the moral of a zombie story is always we're worse than the zombies. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
It's always like you find some community that's like, we are the real monster. And so they're almost like plays, you know, in that way where it's like a pressure cooker, you know, where you're doing a human drama story. And so I think they also, they create a high stakes situation that I think a lot of people want. Like there's, I think, you know, a lot of the stuff you see.
That's interesting.
Like preppers and people that are afraid of the act. People always say, oh, you're afraid of the apocalypse and this and that. I mean, I think there's a desire and sometimes like for not for this terrible thing to happen and to see people die. But I think there is, as weird as it is to say, like a strange wish to suddenly be in a situation where you're not in the mundane like details of life all day. And instead everything is life or death. And you're suddenly in a battle against things that are really defined and trying to survive. Sure. And all of this kind of pedestrian shit melts away. So the zombies.
And also, I think some of those folks just want to shoot some motherfuckers.
Yes. I think there's some of that too baked into the very first, baked into Night of the Living Dead, you know?
I just think
zombies, I feel like, wind up being more about the humans because the zombies are just sort of a, you know, the sort of march of death or destruction like coming at you. But I do think that, you know, vampires have that potential in the way of being like, you know, very, very frightening as actual like walking, talking, knowing reflections of the people you love coming to kill you in a more personal way.
Right on. Have you ever considered reaching out to Stephen King about writing an extension in comic book form of Salem's Lot? Like what's going on with that place now? I feel like I have a lot of fun with that.
I would love that. I mean, I would love to see more because it's one of my favorite mythologies. But no, I mean, when we go back and forth, it's more like we like a lot of the same music, like a lot of Americana and stuff too. And so it's more like, here's a playlist, or have you been like, hey, did you read this? Or thank you for, I saw you that, you know, that. So,
right.
No, I of course, if he said, hey, I want to do a comic, anyone would jump. So
it would let me rephrase. You should contact Stephen King and tell him you want to continue the story of Salem's Lot. If anyone was going to do that, it would be you. And I think, you know, after reading this today, I am suddenly way more invested in this particular mythology than I have been previously. Rereading this really captured my imagination in a way that completely blindsided me. So as a personal favor, I'm going to need you to do that. And
I'll do my best.
Jumping off of what you guys were talking about, it strikes me that King doesn't really play with zombies a lot. He has Cell, which are kind of zombies. He did that great short story Home Delivery, which was like traditional zombies, but he stays pretty far away considering how close he was and how much he reveres Night of the Living Dead like you do and how close he was with Romero. Why do you think you know, as a storyteller, why would you imagine that he like kind of turns away from that? Like even pre-Walking Dead, back when, you know, now that it's oversaturated, but for a long time it wasn't.
That's a great question. I mean, I have to think about it. I mean, I think the same mechanism that you see in a zombie film, you see in a lot of, like, you see in a bunch of his work, like people trapped together, you know, against something and turning against each other, like the mist.
The mist.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Or there are a few other things too, like, you know, Needful Things, as much as they're not trapped, has that message of like, you tempt people or you put people in a pressure cooker, you give them the opportunity to be bad and they'll be bad. So I could see it attracting him or see it be something that he would do. But maybe it's this, the level of complexity and complication to the evil is something that he really seems to revel in. Creating like a mythology around the thing that's manipulating you. I mean, sometimes it's just a thing, like it's, you know, rarely, but like Cujo or whatever. But often it's like something that has its own Lovecraftian strange background or something that has that classic Gothic background or, you know, something again, like a town that burned down that had this satanic history or a cemetery out in the, you know, sour ground that people don't go to anymore. Or, you know, Randall Flagg, who's like in, you know, an ancient evil, the walking man in that way. And so it feels almost like, he likes to develop a personalized kind of thing that tempts and pushes and like calls you onto the dark side of stuff, you know, rather than just having it be a kind of monolithic threat. You know, I think that's the, I mean, I like that too. I love, you know, it's what I love about, I mean, I love that in his work, and I love trying to make those up where it's like, you take a scary kind of a monster that's a classic, or you take something that you've seen as a trope and then try to personalize it, make it something that people haven't seen done that way before, not by giving it a kind of, you know, a background or a kind of legend or an origin that speaks to the things that you're afraid of or that you feel is are potent in that minute in your life. So creating, like when we did Night of the Ghoul, it's about, you know, this monster who's, you know, a ghoul, but that people don't think that it really exists, but it's actually responsible for all these myths of plague bringers back in the day, in ancient Egypt all the way till now. And they curl up and hide inside a person and gestate until they have a plague in them. And then they're ready to kind of come out through your mouth and release
Hell
it.
Yeah.
But that idea of like taking something and it could just be a, you know, a ghoul and they spread a plague and that's that. But having it be something that felt, you know, again, tied to stuff that makes it more daunting and scary because it goes all the way back to the beginning of civilization, making it stuff that felt like you were taking stuff from the pandemic that was happening while we were writing it and bringing it in. And I think my guess is that he enjoys that aspect too, you know?
Yeah. So I guess now would be a good time for you to remind everybody where they can pick up, where and what they can pick up of your newest outing, your newest thing. And yeah, maybe it's time to wrap up.
Yeah, sure. Dude, this has been such a pleasure. I mean, I could talk to you guys forever about all this stuff, but the,
let's do it when my internet's being a little bit more, less shitty.
Fair enough. Fair enough. But maybe on a cruise, it'll be good. Yes. we'll do, yeah. So White Boat number one is out now. There's three issues. They come out every couple months or every 2 months. One will be out. They're 45 pages a piece. And my amazing co-creator, Francesco Francavilla, is one of the biggest horror fans. His office looks like a museum of like Hammer films and all kinds of classic scary movies. So he's dyed in the wool, you know, horror people. And it's about, again, it's about a mysterious sort of ship that brings this ne'er-do-well kind of guy to an island where he discovers all kinds of horrors he didn't expect. So it's definitely kind of in the vein of all of the stuff that we talked about today and inspired by a lot of Stephen King. So I hope you enjoy it. And again, I thank you guys, but also thank you to everybody out there that's been so supportive of my career over the years. A lot of Stephen King fans, you know, come up and have read some of our stuff in comics, and it means the world to have any association at all with him, but also just, you know, that people are still picking up our books in general. So thank you.
Many thanks to Scott Snyder for joining us. Lovely gentleman. I enjoyed that dude immensely. Very talented guy. And I'm very psyched that he came on the show. He's actually somebody we were trying to get for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, thankfully everything worked out and the stars aligned and we got him on to talk about some Stephen King fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Good times all the way around.
Now let's tell you about what's coming up next week. So next Wednesday, we have the director and star of The First Omen. That is Arkasha Stevenson and Nell Tiger Free. Mm-hmm. They're on the publicity circuit kind of. One, it's a little bit of a victory lap for how good that movie ended up being and how well it was received. And two, they are promoting the digital release. And as such, it's a little bit, I want to warn you guys in advance, it's a little bit of a shorter episode for us because they are on a tight schedule. This one clocked in at about almost 40 minutes before edit. So it's going to be a slightly smaller episode, but we really, really loved The First Omen and wanted to have any excuse that we could to have Nell and Arkasha on the show. And so, so we did, and they talk about their favorite King things. So we talk a little bit about It, the miniseries, which is the thing that kind of radicalized Nell as a young horror obsessed child, and Carrie, which was Arkasha's favorite. It is a multifaceted, if short, conversation. Yes. But I hope you guys will enjoy it. That's what's showing up in the main feed next week.
Yes. And this Friday on the Patreon, we are speaking to our pal Jermaine Lussier, or Lucier. I always get his name wrong.
It's Lussier.
Lussier. Yeah.
Yeah, he's corrected us multiple times, and I'm like you, still default in the Lucier.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry, Jermaine. But Jermaine had never seen Misery before, incredibly. Mm-hmm. And when he told me that, I was like, oh, I want to talk to you after you've seen it. We've done a couple of these bonus episodes where someone sees a King classic for the first time. And, you know, we like to get someone right after they've, you know, experienced these things. You know, it's like virgin territory for them. Mm-hmm. And we are, you know, we've fucking seen this thing a million times. So Jermaine comes in, he tells us what he thought of Misery. Of course, this leads to a conversation about the state of, you know, fandom and the way that, you know, I don't know. How do you put it? Like the sense of ownership and entitlement. Ownership. Yes. Yeah. It's kind of inevitable when you're talking about Misery. To avoid this conversation, but also Jermaine has some extensive experience dealing with, say, unruly fandoms over the years. So
yes,
so
he has feel some... like they know best about their particular obsessions and how just accurate that movie and King's original novel was to capturing that feeling, and how it's only grown more accurate over time. But since Jermaine's still deep in the weeds with all that stuff, he's still in the daily content mind there at the in the movie blogging world. He has to deal with all that stuff firsthand every day. So that ended up being a really fun part of the conversation, I think.
Yeah, agreed. So head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast to sign up if you're not already subscribed. And you should be subscribed. If you're only listening to the show in the main feed, you're only getting half the show. We have dozens upon dozens, if not hundreds, of episodes for you to get caught up on over there. Deep dives, interviews, commentaries, all kinds of shit. Plus, if you sign up in our highest tier, you'll get access to the KingCast Discord, which is a nonstop party. You want to be at that party. Trust me. It's a wild and lawless place. I love our Discord community. And I think that about does it. Yeah.
Hell yeah. Yeah. So we'll see y'all next week for that chat with Arkasha and Nell in the main feed. And then this Friday, talking to Jermaine about Misery on our Patreon.
See you later, folks.
Bye.
The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.